It's Central Time. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up on Central Time, President Trump is trying to light a fire under congressional Republicans to get them to come to an agreement over the new health care bill. Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch faces another day of confirmation hearings and more. We'll talk to Paul Singer from USA Today about the latest in national politics.
First, a new report is looking at varying levels of voter engagement in different parts of the United States. Wisconsin stands out in the report because the state saw the nation's second highest drop in voter turnout since 2012.
Wisconsin was a battleground state during the election. It's also been front and center in debates over voter ID laws and redistricting.
George Pillsbury joins us now. He's authored the new report, which is called America Goes to the Polls 2016. He's also a senior consultant for the nonprofit organization Vote. George, welcome to Central Time.
Well, I'm glad to be here.
George, can you put the numbers in context for us? How big is the voter turnout drop in Wisconsin?
Well, it was second highest in the nation, percentage-wise, and actually it was the most in terms of total votes lost. And that's that was, you know, a surprise to us. It was only four states really lost votes compared to 2012 in this election.
And Wisconsin is typically a state with high voter turnout. How does this number compare to voter engagement in past elections? Can you give us a little more context?
Well, Wisconsin's always been a high voter turnout state. In fact, it's been number two ranking for the last 4 years for presidential elections. So when it dropped to fifth, that was, we raised a flag, but then we looked at the numbers and sorted it. We saw that Wisconsin was right up there with Mississippi with the largest drop in voter turnout.
So Mississippi, was Mississippi the state with the highest drop, then, you said?
That was number one, and although, again, Wisconsin was number one just in terms of the number of voters lost compared to 2012.
Do you have a sense?
That was just a little bit of a surprise again, because the voting eligible population did increase in Wisconsin, so you should have been higher. And of course, it should have been higher for some other reasons as well.
So, when you say should have been higher, what do you mean by that?
Well, it was a very competitive state. I mean, states, first of all, that are considered battleground states are going to have higher turnout. They're going to get a lot more attention. And number two, you had not only a battleground presidential race, but a big U.S. Senate race. So I think that was kind of a double winner in the competition, and we expected an increase rather than a decrease in turnout.
So you said Wisconsin and Mississippi had the biggest drops between this election and the one 4 years ago. Any sense about why that is?
Well, I think there's a number of reasons you could look at, but one thing that we did notice is they both introduced very strict voter ID laws since 2012. And I think that could have had an impact. Certainly, we also look at other factors, like the fact that there was some, you know, drop off of, let's say, Obama's voters from 2012. That happened in other states as well, though. But I think you have to look for something, something that structurally changed in how Wisconsin held its elections.
And it's my understanding that your report did not look expressly at voter ID laws, although you suspect that could have had something to do with it. But why is that? Why didn't you take that into account?
Well, we're a nonprofit vote. We're a nonpartisan organization. And we, I think voter ID for us is a little bit, unfortunately, is seen as a partisan issue, which is too bad. I think, you know, too many of these issues are seen as partisan when really, at the end of the day, it's really about the voters and having and it shouldn't be about the parties or the candidates. So it's a little bit harder to pull out the effect of voter ID. We know it has a suppressive effect. We don't know how much, and we're not an organization that can judge that. However, it did kind of jump out in the findings that the two biggest losers of turnout were the strict ID states.
And the 2016 election was also notable because both the major party nominees were incredibly unpopular. What did that have to do with the turnout, if anything?
Well, I'm not sure at the end of the day, because, you know, it's interesting that I know that, for example, in Wisconsin, I think that both of the candidates that Wisconsin voters supported in the primaries did not end up getting nominated. But that also was the same case in the other high turnout states. So the other top five states also had that same situation, but they still had high turnout, and they didn't change much from 2012. In fact, in most cases, it went up. So I don't, Yeah, so we go back to now that there's another factor there. There's also the question of said you had competitive Senate race and a presidential race, but if people were not satisfied with the candidates, maybe they're looking for another candidate on the ballot to vote for, like their congressperson. There wasn't a choice this year in Wisconsin in any of your eight congressional races. They're all landslide elections, and they're pretty uncompetitive.
We're talking with George Pillsbury right now, senior consultant for the nonprofit organization Vote and author of the study America Goes to the Polls 2016. And one thing you did, or several things I should say that you looked at, is what policies did encourage voter turnout and participation. What did you find there?
Well, the one that continues to have the biggest impact, and this is when Wisconsin was a leader in a few decades ago, and that's the ability to register or to fix correct your registration when you go to vote. It's called same-day registration. Now, your state's had it since the 1970s, certainly a pioneer in that area, and that's why you're with Minnesota and Maine and New Hampshire is always in the top five, usually. Another big factor is the issue of competition. If you're a battleground state, you're going to get higher turnout. You're going to get more attention. Campaigns devoted 99% of their money and 95% of their campaign appearances to the 14 battleground states. The people in the other 36 states just, elections kind of preordained and there's less turnout. So Wisconsin did have the battleground status and does have same-day registration. Those are the big policies. I think there's some other ones that we're looking at now that we saw in Oregon introduced automatic voter registration. Again, probably not as much of an issue in Wisconsin with the same day, but it's Oregon also. Oregon actually conversely had the opposite, had the highest turnout increased when it introduced, it automatically registers voters now when they go to their Department of Motor Vehicles. So, and that's really helped Oregon, probably as well as some of their mail voting scheme they have out there, along with Washington and Colorado.
Now, the issues of gerrymandering and also redistricting have become especially hot topics after the 2016 elections, and you have bearing here in Wisconsin. What effect do you think that redistricting, for example, may have on voter turnout?
Well, I think it's it definitely has an impact, and as it should. I mean, I think most states still are like Wisconsin. I think the people who are elected are drawing the lines. They get to choose the voters before the voters choose them. So that's a problem, and they're going to end up tending to create safer districts or districts that are better for the incumbents of one party or both parties. So we did see it. With the redistricting controversy, and I think we see it across many states, this year we saw the lowest competition in the congressional races that we've seen in the last at least 30 years. Only 37 out of 435 congressional seats in this country were at all competitive. Three-quarters were won by landslide margins, and so we're not really giving voters much of a choice the way we draw our districts.
And, George, next presidential election in 4 years, anything big you'll be looking for then?
I think, a number of states are moving forward with, I would say, positive reforms that really help people vote. We're going to see more states, seven of them have adopted automatic voter registration, so that's getting more folks registered who might not otherwise register. Because it's happening, automatically when they go renew their driver's license or a state ID. We're seeing over a third of the states now have same-day voter registration. They followed Wisconsin's lead on that one, and that's really starting to raise turnout, which is why, in fact, turnout overall nationally remained high compared to prior presidential years, because the laws are starting to change in a positive direction, which a lot of people don't hear. They hear a lot about the controversial ID and other things, but I think our report highlights a lot of the positive reforms which are happening, and I think will continue to increase turnout. Some of those I mentioned, and I guess I would put some of the new techniques of mail voting, which is called mail voting, but it's really a system in Colorado that they've developed where everybody gets their ballot 2 weeks ahead of time, and they get plenty of time to look at it, review it, figure it out. And they, you know, don't have to mail it back. They can just chop it off, bring it back, and they're much more informed and more likely to vote.
George, thank you so much for joining us.
Well, good. Thank you. Good luck in your future elections.
Thank you so much. That was George Pillsbury, senior consultant for the nonprofit organization Vote. He authored a report called America Goes to the Polls 2016.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, Wisconsin consistently gets high marks for having some of the best health care in the country, but many rural residents have difficulty accessing that care. We'll talk with two state lawmakers about legislation being proposed that could help.
Right now, it's time for our check-in on the latest political news out of Washington, D.C. The GOP's revised health care law has many people worried that more people could lose coverage, and President Trump is calling on congressional Republicans to coalesce around a plan.
The Associated Press released a report detailing the news that former Trump campaign manager Paul Manafort received millions of dollars from a Russian billionaire to promote a pro-Putin agenda. And there's new information from the House intelligence chief over the president's wiretapping allegations.
Paul Singer joins us now. He's Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on this slow news day.
Yeah, not much going on. How about sports? News broke this afternoon. House Intelligence Chair Devin Nunes of California made this announcement. Here's a listen.
So first, I recently confirmed that on numerous occasions, the intelligence community incidentally collected information about U.S. citizens involved in the Trump transition. Details about U.S. persons associated with the incoming administration, details with little or no apparent foreign intelligence value, were widely disseminated in intelligence community reporting. Third, I have confirmed that additional names of Trump transition team members were unmasked. And fourth and finally, I want to be clear, none of this surveillance was related to Russia or the investigation of Russian activities or of the Trump team.
All right, so this is big, Paul. Break it down for us. It sounds like this is incidental, so not that these individuals are being targeted. It's that they had communication with foreign persons who were targeted. Is that right?
Right. That's right. The critical word here is incidental collection. The whole notion is that these people, we don't know who they are, were overheard on wiretaps that were being conducted because of legal spying, basically, by U.S. law enforcement. So, and this is the deal, is that if I call, you know, bad guy X in, you know, wherever a stand, and they're eavesdropping on that call, despite the fact I'm an American person, I can be picked up in that call. The thing that I think is most concerning for Mr. Nunes is that, in general, the rules are supposed to be that my name then gets blacked out and the collection of information gets eliminated if it has nothing to do with the whatever activity they're trying to pursue. And it sounds like that did not happen, and the names were, as he said, unmasked and then shared amongst other intelligence agencies. So now my name is circulating around on some piece of paper somewhere that's not supposed to be.
This is there's been a lot of reaction to this already, just since this has been announced. The president himself, the House Intelligence Chair Devin Nunes, apparently was going to brief the president. He's done that by now, I think, which you tweeted seemed a bit odd.
Right. Yeah, it's weird because, of course, Mr. Nunes is supposed to be running the investigation of the connections or contacts between Russia and the Trump campaign, that is, between Russian agents and the Trump campaign. Now, what Mr. Nunes has said is that these intercepted communications were unrelated to that investigation. So I think he wanted to just alert the president that some of his team had been picked up on this other surveillance. And Mr. Trump, of course, says he feels vindicated because he was accusing the Obama administration, in fact, President Obama, of wiretapping Trump Tower. That is not what this is. This is not a wiretap of Mr. Trump or his associates by the Obama administration. This is, again, they are incidental contacts. They are being picked up on wiretaps of other people.
We've seen spokespeople for Adam Schiff, the Democratic counterpart of Devin Nunes on this House Intelligence Committee, saying, basically, news to us, we hadn't seen this information.
Yeah, there's some oddities about this whole process, unlike every other day around here these days, where it seems like Mr. Nunez has not disclosed to the Democrats on his committee what it exactly is the information he's dealing with, where he's getting it. He says it came from sources. He hasn't explained to us what those sources are. He says we'll find out more on Friday. But again, many questions yet to be answered here as usual, and yes, it's a little odd.
And this all comes in the backdrop of the testimony earlier this week from the FBI director saying no wiretapping of Trump Tower, no surveillance of the Trump transition or campaign. Yes, ongoing investigation of possible links between Russian intelligence of the Russian state and the Trump campaign. So that was the last big bombshell, I guess, in intelligence this week.
Yeah, they're not bombshells anymore. I mean, there's like one every other day.
Drumbeat, yeah.
Drumbeat, I think, is exactly the thing. And again, this raises more questions. Who was it that the Trump people were talking to that the FBI was so concerned about they were listening in?
And then on the Russian connection with the Trump team, this news from the AP looking at Paul Manafort. He was Donald Trump's campaign manager for a few months during the campaign. Looking back 10 years or so now, he had contracted apparently with Russian oligarchs, if people want to call them that, wealthy Russians, for a campaign on behalf to build support for the Putin administration in the United States, in former Soviet republics. What do we know about that?
Not much. I mean, it is worth keeping in mind this was 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. I think what is most interesting about this is that Manafort has said all along that he was not working for Russia and Russian interests. This contract would suggest that he was working, at least for a Russian businessman who wanted him to expressly advance Russian interests. So it casts some doubt on Manafort's prior protestations that he was not working for the Russians. But again, this goes back 10 years before the campaign, so it's not clear how much it changes our perception or information about how the campaign was running.
So what are you watching for next in the Russia-Trump campaign open investigation? Are you expecting to see revelations soon, or is this something that's going to be percolating for a long time now?
No, I think, in fact, the funny thing about the way this all played out is that with Mr. Comey's testimony at the beginning of the week, he basically said there is an investigation of the Trump campaign's contacts with Russia, and I'm not going to tell you anything else about it. So it just becomes, as I think Mr. Nunez said, a gray cloud that hangs over the administration. Who knows what we'll find, what we'll hear, when. It could be months. It could be longer. It will simply always be a question mark that, you know, every new email that pops up will be a new news story.
Talking to Paul Singer from USA Today about the top news stories from national politics this week. On a normal week, Paul, we're getting now to the stories that would be the top news. Healthcare bill, first and foremost among them. President Trump, full court press here on Republicans in Congress, conservatives in particular, saying, yeah, no, we're not going to vote for this. We've got the votes to block it. Everybody's kind of trying to count the votes here, the whip tally, I think they call it. What are we seeing?
Yep. Well, I don't know. What time is it? I mean, really, we're getting press releases now from members of Congress all over the place saying, yes, I've decided to vote for the bill. No, I've decided not to vote for the bill. And it's just a question of keeping your chalkboard updated. At the moment, what is interesting to me is people like Congressman Lo Biondo from New Jersey, a moderate, not a conservative, saying he cannot support this bill because he is concerned about its impact on senior citizens and cutting some of the supports for them that are in the Obamacare bill. That's interesting. The whole argument here has been that the very conservative core of about 30 or 40 members of the Republican caucus might reject this bill because it doesn't go far enough. They said today they think they got 25 votes, which would be enough to kill the bill. It gets harder for the Republicans if they've got a conservative core plus a handful of moderates rejecting the bill. Now you have to really start looking at this count. Do they have enough votes to pass this bill in the House?
And those moderates, more moderate Republicans in Congress and the House, may have more counterparts, it looks like, in the Senate. So even if something can pass the House, it's not a guarantee it's going to pass the Senate, right?
Oh, yeah. This bill's dead in the Senate. I mean, that's a given. I mean, one of the things that's interesting is that the conservatives in the Senate who oppose this bill, too, have said basically to their, in some cases, have said to the House members, don't walk the plank for a dead bill. whatever happens in the Senate, they're going to have to rewrite this bill to make it more palatable to moderates. So then you ask this question, well, then what happens when the House gets that back? If they didn't like this bill, they're going to hate that one. But it may be their only chance to repeal Obamacare. So what do they do? It's a fascinating calculation that you have to make if you are a conservative member of Congress who's been saying for 10 years, well, 7 years, we're going to repeal this bill.
I want to spend a couple of minutes on one of the lesser stories, one of these below-the-fold stories for people who still get print newspapers. The Supreme Court nomination confirmation hearings going on this week. Day three. How are things going today?
It's amazing this is below the fold, by the way. It used to be the name of my bluegrass band. The hearings have been without bombshell, which I think is good news for Mr. Gorsuch. Remember here that the issue for the Democrats is a level of outrage that you might be able to consider justified that President Obama's nominee never got a hearing at all, and yet here there is a Republican nominee for the same seat, and here they are whistling through these hearings. Basically, you know, the issues with Mr. Gorsuch are ideological ones. There's no one is complaining he's unqualified. No one is complaining that he's a bad human being. What their complaint is that he is, you know, an originalist, a textualist. He believes that he should narrowly interpret the law and the Constitution as written and not extend his hopes and dreams into those documents. And in some cases, that ends up with what Mr. Gorsuch is admitting can be some kind of heartless rulings where you end up saying, sorry, that guy ends up with a bad deal, but that's because the law was written that way, and I can't change the law just to help him out. That's up to Congress. That's really the gist of the debate over the past 2 days. Democrats, again, very unhappy with the whole process, but I'm not sure they're inclined to filibuster, and I'm not sure they've got enough votes to stop him.
We'll leave it there for now. Paul, always good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Rob. Let's hope for more news.
I think we'll not be disappointed. That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. He joined us to give us some of the latest in the big stories in national politics.
Coming up after the news, we'll learn about new legislation aimed at improving health care access in rural Wisconsin. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, we'll talk about Monday's meeting of the Great Lakes Compact Council in Chicago, reviewing Waukesha's plan to divert water from Lake Michigan.
First, Wisconsin is known for having, across the board, some of the best health care in the country. But for residents living in rural parts of the state, access to high-quality health care can be hard to find, with some counties lacking OBGYNs and other specialists.
But a group of lawmakers known as the Rural Wisconsin Initiative have introduced bills aimed at reducing some of these health care disparities.
We're joined now by two members of the Rural Wisconsin Initiative, Representative Romaine Quinn. Welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
And Representative Krug, welcome to the show.
Yeah, it's good to be back on the air again.
Well, Representative Krug, let's start with you, the Rural Wisconsin Initiative. We're talking about health in rural Wisconsin, and it's not just about health of individuals, right? This is about communities.
Right. It's about systems. It's about communities. It's about making sure there's access in the most rural of areas. Representative Quinn, myself, the other members of the Rural Wisconsin Initiative have amazingly large and rural districts, and it's hard for folks to even get to healthcare systems. So when they do, we got to make sure the right systems are in place.
And Representative Quinn, how important is this to the economy and the existence of a lot of these communities to have this access to healthcare?
Absolutely. In many communities, your healthcare systems could be your biggest employers, right next to your local school district. So it is absolutely critical to the economics of the area. And all these issues we have, whether it's our healthcare package or technology package or workforce readiness or education that are in the Rural Wisconsin Initiative, they really all play hand in hand. So they're all a critical component of the future success of rural Wisconsin.
And when I talk to older relatives trying to figure out where they want to settle, they want to be within a certain distance of healthcare. When I talk to my younger cousins with kids, they want to be close to a doctor for their kids. Is that part of the story here, Representative Krug?
It is, and it's always part of the story for rural Wisconsin is the access to services. I mean, we have, you know, like I mentioned, the huge swarm of area that we have that have to cover and to try to get people to and not only enjoy the lakes in my area or Representative Quinn's area or other areas, but to understand that it's, you know, we're going to have broadband availability, we're going to have health care availability, workforce development initiatives. So as we worked on these other initiatives over the last 2 years, we started dealing with the health care issues this time. Starting to understand that nationwide things are changing in healthcare. Statewide, we're going to have to adapt. And even more locally, we're going to have to make sure that other things are in place that the state can help out with.
So, Representative Quinn, what do you do about this?
Right, absolutely. So there's a number of issues that go on in terms of healthcare. So first and foremost, it's hard to attract people or keep people in rural Wisconsin for the various reasons we've listed. So part of it, too, in terms of access, is actually having the advanced clinicians there to actually do the work. And so one of the bills we have looks to expand rotations for advanced practice clinicians, so such as physician assistants and nurse practitioners. So we're providing rural hospitals with a matching grant because we know their bottom lines are much different than many of our urban or suburban hospitals. So they have the ability to attract and keep those people in their rotations during that time because we know where they end their rotations, they're more likely to stay. So it opens up an opportunity that currently doesn't exist for many rural hospitals and to try and attract and keep some of those practitioners right in our rural communities.
And Representative Krug, how do you do that? That new clinician, they could get paid more in an urban area. They might see more amenities in an urban area. So how do you incentivize ending up in that rural community?
You know, the best incentive I've ever found for anybody to want to stay locally is for somebody to invest in their options to stay locally. And that's what we're really trying to do, is make that investment into people this time around. And this, you know, the Rural Wisconsin Initiative doesn't exist in a vacuum. We're working on other issues in the state budget that go along with this. So we're talking about, you know, individuals needing access to care. We're working with disproportionate share payments for the hospital association to cover those who don't have health insurance. When we're talking about physicians and clinicians and residency spots, these are all things that the state is weighing on, saying, you know what, we can make those investments. We have the dollars in the budget this time around, so we're going to make sure that as dollars exist, we can put them back into our communities and invest in the people who live there right now, who we want to stay to work for the rest of their lives.
We've been talking about people who do, clinicians who do the general stuff. How about specialists? I hear about mental health care. People have nothing in the area. When it comes to addiction treatment, the northernmost methadone clinic in Wisconsin, I believe, is in Wausau.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of Wisconsin north of Wausau. How do you get that kind of specialty, whether we're talking mental health care or cardiology or OBGYN, you name it?
Sure, absolutely. And you mentioned a couple different important issues. So one, meth addiction and other addictions in rural Wisconsin are taking a particular toll on your county budgets, your local budgets, your law enforcement, and it's a big deal right now. And so we're happy with the work that Representative John Nygren is doing with his HOPE agenda. And part of that, we're looking to work within the scope of his HOPE agenda to apply that to rural Wisconsin. So there's a bill right now outside of the Rural Initiative that would expand the number of treatment clinics from 3 to 6. And these clinics are currently in rural areas, I believe, over near Marinette, one in Ashland, and other places. So we're looking to expand that from 3 to 6. So that's an important component, too. But same thing with OB doctors. I'm glad you mentioned that. So last session, we had a bill to expand the RIPRAP program, the Rural Residency Physician Program. And the Medical College of Wisconsin wanted to use that fund, that increase in funds, to start a first-in-the-nation-ever rural residency for OB doctors, because we know that 1 in every 3 counties in Wisconsin does not have an OB specialist. So it's not saying that family practice doctors can't deliver babies or don't do a good job, but there's something to be said about that. And why would I move to a county when I know I have to drive an hour one way to have my children? To have, you know, my first child. So, again, that's why all of these issues play an important role in the survivability of rural Wisconsin in terms of attraction, retention, and that workforce development piece going forward.
You know,
and we're happy to see that legislation. Last time, the governor took that and put it in his budget this time. So we're happy that these initiatives are starting to move.
And, I think it just plays to the point that when you talk specialists that, you know, I live in Adams County, one of the most rural counties in the state. We don't have a pediatric dental provider in the entire county. We have to go almost to Milwaukee for somebody that takes Medicare payments for dental services. So as we talk about the bills we're working on today, they're the tip of the iceberg. There are so many other areas that we can make targeted investments in to attract people more to central Wisconsin or to northwest Wisconsin or to more rural areas of the state. So, you know, as we get started, this is kind of just where we take off from.
Talking to Assembly Representative Scott Krug and Romaine Quinn, looking at the Rural Wisconsin Initiative, the part that focuses on providing health care, giving health care access to more parts of rural Wisconsin. Representative Krug, we've talked a lot about the people providing the health care, the doctors, the clinicians, the nurses. How about infrastructure? Do we have buildings for them to work in? Do we have the equipment they need in the rural areas?
You know, I have to give the biggest credit in the whole healthcare system for rural Wisconsin takes off, I think, from Marshfield Clinic. And I think having that centrally localized in Marshfield, you know, with offices throughout the northwest part of the state in central Wisconsin, they've become a really integral partner in some of the things we're working on to make sure that Marshfield Clinic and the associated hospitals in that program are, you know, able to maintain their bottom line and still provide affordable care. So I think the infrastructure is there. It's just a matter of making sure that we make the investment to help them maintain their services and expand even more into more rural areas.
Representative Quinn, anything you want to add on that?
Yeah, absolutely. We're fortunate in my district. And again, when I say the 75th Assembly District in Rice Lake, Wisconsin, in Barron County, you know, people say, well, you're all the way up north. Well, that's not even the far north. There's much more north than even I am. But we are very fortunate that we have, you know, Marshfield has just recently built a state-of-the-art campus medical clinic and hospital right in the heart of Rice Lake that brings people from all over the area. We're fortunate to have Mayo Clinic services in Rice Lake, and they have a hospital in Barron. So, like I think Scott mentioned, you know, the infrastructure is there, but, you know, how do we help them? Because they're going through the same problem. They can't function as a system if they don't have the practitioners to do the work in these facilities. So how can we partner with them? So that's why it's important, too, is these aren't just grants that don't require anything. We're not just handing money to hospitals. We're requiring, you know, matching grants where the state and these in the various systems come in and say, here's a need, and how can we address this together? And I think that piece is very important, especially when we know that 30 hospitals in the state last year lost money. Mm-hmm. So they're not all profitable. So how can we provide minimal but targeted investments to ensure their success and, frankly, the success of our people in our districts?
Representative Krug, can you talk about the fiscal impact, the budget impact of the health care spending that would be involved in the Rural Wisconsin Initiative?
You know, and that's the nice thing about the things we're working on is that, you know, as Romaine talked about, we really minimize that impact because we're working with partners to make sure that we're making sure there's skin in the game from other partners. So we're, you know, understanding the fact that we have a very large state budget that has many things that are competing, so we don't want to break the bank in all these initiatives, but still want to make sure that rural Wisconsin is getting its share. So we're keeping the price tag as low as we possibly can and making the most targeted investments. Again, understanding that we have to make sure that the hospitals we're working with in the budgets are able to take care of critical access patients and keep their emergency rooms open, keep that bottom line going so we can even talk about expanding in programs for residency and qualified health providers and things like that. So it's, you know, there is an impact to it. Thankfully, we, you know, going into this budget, we got a little bit of a surplus so we can start putting those dollars back into the systems that need them.
Representative Quinn, going over the list, it seems like Republicans mostly or completely on the list on this one. Do you see bipartisan cooperation? Have you talked to your Democratic colleagues on this?
Yeah, absolutely. And we've had bipartisanship on some of the other bills in here. These are fairly new, so sometimes it takes the other side a little bit to warm up to them, and rightfully so, because, of course, you do have some of that partisanship. Some of those games that do exist, unfortunately, in the building, but at the end of the day, I think we're all going to work for the greater good, and I think you're going to see a lot of them working with us, offering amendments with us. And my bill in particular, you know, the second lead on that is Representative Colstie, who's a Democrat, and she has a nursing background, so she was absolutely key in making sure that this was bipartisan because she recognized the need for it. So we do work together more than gets portrayed, and I think you're going to see more and more of that with our initiative because we developed this initiative not on partisan issues, on issues that just make sense for rural Wisconsin, and how do we move rural Wisconsin forward on issues that we can all agree on that don't have a partisan flair. So that's what these bills do.
We'll leave it there for now. Representative Quinn, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And Representative Krug, thanks for coming up.
Yeah, anytime. Really, anytime.
We've been talking to State Assembly Representative Scott Krug of Nakusa and Romaine Quinn of Rice Lake. They joined us to talk about new rural health care initiatives being proposed in the state legislature.
Coming up, we'll continue the conversation about rural health care with John Eich, Director of the Wisconsin Office on Rural Health.
We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about access to health care in rural areas of Wisconsin. We just heard from two state assembly members who are part of a coalition of lawmakers aiming to boost health care access.
John Eich joins us now. He's director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health. That's part of the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's with us to talk about what's at stake in these rural areas. John, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for the invite.
Well, what health issues are we watching for in rural areas that maybe we could help by providing better access to health care?
Well, certainly. I think what you tend to see in rural areas are primary care. So if people go for their specialist, if they go for cardiology, that's not going to be in a small community. That's going to be into a larger facility. So what we're looking at is primary care providers and the team-based care. And I think these bills, we were very pleased to see the Rural Wisconsin Initiative put forward these bills, really start to address some of the workforce issues, some of the allied health professionals that can help, and the advanced practice clinicians to help out with that. So that's certainly something that we can benefit from.
Looking into the legislation, what are some of the high points that, if passed, you think could make the biggest difference?
Well, I do think that, you know, so what we need are sort of practitioners in the field, but it's not something you can turn on like a switch. You have to sort of grow them, so to speak. And so we need programming, and we have programming here, both of our medical schools for rural physicians and then residencies. And this one of these bills looks at providing rotations and hopefully someday maybe even more residencies for the advanced practice clinicians, so your physician assistants, your nurse practitioners, as well as then working into the field of physical therapists, surgical techs, et cetera. So that's a great step. I mean, we need to get people educated in rural issues, context of healthcare, and then we need to help train them for the kind of care that they're going to deliver. The more that we can do that in a rural community, the better, because then they won't have to leave their small town. They can stay in a context that feels comfortable for them and then continue to practice.
Talk about, I don't know if this is overstating it, but maybe the bidding war that a rural healthcare provider might face in trying to lure and retain healthcare providers, keep them from going elsewhere.
Right. So, you know, recruiting new providers is always a tricky thing. And what we find is, you know, there's often a perception that, well, if I go work in rural, I'm going to be paid in hay bales or something. I'm kidding. But that the reality is that the not only are the salaries competitive, they're often a little better because employers are aware that they need to provide something that will definitely lure the best and the brightest out to areas. And so, yes, you'll have different systems around the state in different rural areas. And so providers are in a really good position there to say, well, I want something near the lakes up north. I would rather not have this kind of practice dynamic, et cetera. So it's a good place to be for them.
Wisconsin, of course, not the only rural state in the country. Are there lessons we can learn? Are there states that are getting this right, meeting these needs?
Yes. I would say that, what we've seen, sort of the development in the two medical schools for education, specifically around rural, for physicians is great. We're starting to see that the PA program, physician and assistant program, has expanded into rural as well. OB, I think, was just highlighted, obstetrics, as doing a rural residency. And so those are all great steps. I think we're doing the right thing there.
Here in Wisconsin, you're saying those are all things working. Are there
exactly
models in other states that could be educational or useful to us too?
Well, I think the concept of a rural educational track or a rural residency is happening in other states, and our people are actually collaborating with them. There's sort of a national conclave of rural training tracks that they meet with annually to learn from them and bring that here.
Talking to John Eich, director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health. That's part of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at efforts to provide more access to health care in rural parts of Wisconsin. We just heard from a couple state lawmakers involved in an effort to do just that. John, I want to look at some other areas of health care. You, I understand, testified today about community EMTs and emergency medical service providers. Talk about what's at stake with these emergency response teams in rural areas.
Yeah, so not part of the Rural Wisconsin Initiative set of bills, but also very important, I think, for rural. People talk about, so a community EMT or a community paramedic is someone who doesn't just respond when you dial 911. That's an emergency situation. They do it in non-emergent. So they visit your home. A lot of times, if you think about post-discharge from the hospital, people are coming out of a surgery. They're okay to go home, but they still are probably on pain medication. They're a little confused about what's going on. And we escort them to the door and say, good luck with that. Home health does not necessarily, I don't think they're paid to come before the third day. And those are three critical days for follow-up care and handoffs. So that's an area where we feel there are gaps, different gaps in different rural communities. For a community paramedic or community EMT to step in, to visit the home, to check out, to do some medication reconciliation, to talk the patient through the issues, and help them succeed and help the patient outcomes be better. They've shown in a Madison pilot that in 1 year, using six patients, two community paramedics saved $500,000 for the hospital that was sponsoring them. So that's the kind of cost savings these programs can see to Medicare and Medicaid and ultimately to the taxpayers. So it's a win-win from our perspective.
Is transportation part of the story here? Because in a more urban setting, that healthcare might be 10 minutes away or even public transit away. In these rural settings, we're talking maybe an hour or two.
It's true. Well, not only that, but if you or your loved one is in the hospital, if you think about how you want to be there by the bedside, well, now if they're an hour away, you have to commute. People are taking off work. The distance from care is always an issue. You think about the golden hour they talk about for reaction to trauma. So if you're driving somewhere that the cell signal isn't maybe as good as it should be, so you have an accident and you wait till the next car to come by, they drive somewhere to get a phone in. It takes the EMTs 15 minutes to get there, 15 minutes to get to the hospital, et cetera. We're really eating up into the time that you should be receiving care. So definitely distance is a significant issue for rural.
Now, we've been hearing, and I mentioned this to the lawmakers we talked to earlier, gaps, especially in mental health coverage and addiction treatment coverage in rural Wisconsin. How big a part of the story is that?
Yeah, behavioral health, mental health, and substance abuse, sort of all as a, you know, they're huge issues. Across the board, urban, rural, there's really not a good payment system for behavioral health issues or for substance abuse. We've narrowed down the options. So, and rural is no different. I mean, as you pointed out in your interview, the options when you get into lesser populated areas thin out very quickly. So certainly we're as interested as anyone in seeing more opportunities for behavioral health care and substance abuse treatment.
If I can ask you a big question as we start to wrap up, of course, we're watching the news from Washington, possible changes to national health care laws. What's at stake? You don't have to break down all the details. What's at stake for rural health care here in Wisconsin?
Well, I think, you know, primarily it's kind of a whiplash effect. So the Affordable Care Act happened, and it was a big change in a lot of different ways that we don't even hear about beyond the coverage. There's a lot of regulations to get used to. There's business models that have changed. And so for small rural facilities that do not have a team on every issue, they have one person who's probably doing something else at the same time. They have been in good faith making all of these changes to their programming. And so now for the legislators to change it, I do hope they're considering what that will mean for healthcare providers who are trying to provide high quality care, what that will mean, what the changes will look like. I think there's possibilities. There's possibilities for good things to happen and possibilities for not so good things to happen. It remains to be seen.
Apart from the content of the bills, would you like to see more effort at whatever the change is, making it easier for these providers to comply with whatever the new change is?
Yes. I mean, I think maybe a personal plug here. So the Office of Rural Health, that's what we do. We get federal funding to help rural providers work through things like this to provide support. And that's the sort of thing that I think they're missing is, okay, we've talked about what kind of reimbursement they have, but we've not talked about the impact, the change those changes will make, and how that's going to, everybody's going to have to change their workflow. So I do think that there should be some consideration of that in their lawmaking.
We'll leave it there for now. John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We've been talking to John Eich. He's director of the Wisconsin Office of Rural Health, which is part of the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Join us to talk about the challenges facing rural health care access in Wisconsin and what lawmakers can do to help. And earlier, we talked to two of those lawmakers, Scott Krug and Romaine Quinn, part of the Rural Wisconsin Initiative. Talked to them just a little earlier about some changes that they're looking for to help boost access to health care in rural Wisconsin. You can share your thoughts, your hopes, and maybe even your experiences as a healthcare provider or recipient in rural parts of the state. You can do that on Twitter at Central Time WPR.
We learned this morning on the Joy Cardine Show that today is National Goof Off Day, apparently a day to embrace some good-humored fun and silliness and to do something to break the everyday routine.
Joy's guest, that was after 8 this morning, gave some advice on how to do that. It was a lot of fun, and you can check that out in our archives at WPR.org.
And, Rob, we observed the occasion.
We went nuts.
We went completely
it was wild.
Crazy. We went out and had a quick lunch.
That's right.
Instead, that was not at our desk.
Right. We didn't go out and get something and eat it at our desks. We went out and ate lunch.
We didn't microwave anything.
Right.
We went to an establishment
restaurant
where they sold food.
Yeah. It was really exciting. It was really quite a break from the usual routine.
Then it was refreshing.
It was kind of nice. It was kind of nice. Then I tried to get a treat on the way back, and that was a fiasco. I won't delve into
that.
Well,
certain people weren't so particular about which kind of cookies they purchased.
Well, but if there's a really good chocolate chip cookie, and there's really just noticeably inferior non-chocolate chip cookies, why compromise?
There were many perfectly serviceable cookies.
All right, so I may be too fussy to enjoy National Goof. Though, for me, in some ways, every day is Goof Off Day. I mean, you know, I throw the paper airplanes. I make the jokes that everyone appreciates.
Yes.
The pretending to close the
By
door on people trick.
Two or three people for sure appreciate your jokes.
Everybody appreciates my jokes. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.